So this morning, in the Religion and Public Life Cafe, we're welcoming Ray Sawatsky, who comes from the Fraser Valley. So he came on a fruit cart.
I came just from the Cranberry Festival. We were literally just at the Cranberry Festival.
At the Cranberry Festival.
So there you go.
So his hands are a bit red. I've known Ray for several years and pleased to call him a friend. His formation, I've heard about this in the past in our personal conversations. His formation was in the Closed Brethren tradition, something that is almost as good as the 2x2s that have shaped someone else in our midst. And his pilgrimage in the context of the Christian tradition has always struck me as being very moving and worth hearing about and worth engaging. And so I'm delighted that he's here. He also works in the as a high school teacher, a master teacher. I've never sat under him, but I'm planning to return to high school to finally finish my high school diploma. And but Ray's work with students has always struck me as profound. He has taken students regularly to Europe on a kind of initiation that is something that many of the faculty here at Augustana engage in as well. And he also works in the charitable nonprofit sector a bit. So I'm delighted you're here, and I'm delighted you're going to speak with us a bit, and that people get a chance to engage you around these matters.
Wonderful.
So it's nice to welcome you as a friend to many of my friends who've gathered here.
Thank you, David. David gave this talk a very provocative title, From an Exclusive to a Broad Faith, and so I hope we can achieve something in that range this morning.
Can you all hear?
What I'm hoping will happen is that this is less of a talk and more of a conversation, so I would actually welcome that as we go, because really my journey through faith has been one that has been shaped by conversations and many of them with David over the years, and so that would be very beneficial to me as well if we did it in that way. What I would like to do to kind of get us thinking is just paint for you six images of moments in my life, in my faith journey, and allow those images to hopefully provoke a conversation which David will navigate. For context, I was born into a Close Brethren church. My father and grandfather were elders in those churches, and I was raised with a very strict adherence to a single truth, without any room for conversation. And from that has evolved to a very different place today. So the six images for you. When I was approximately five, I couldn't tell you exactly when, but at some point where I was perceived by my parents to be able to understand the gospel as it was preached in our church on a Sunday morning, if you can imagine a very nondescript church building, two floors where you would go upstairs and you would enter into a Sunday morning worship service where there was a closed circle. And in the middle of that closed circle, a very small table, maybe 4x4, with a single glass of wine on it and a loaf of bread. Outside of that circle was two or three rows of chairs that were considered the back seat, as it was called. And at this point, when I was about 5 years old, my mom, for the first time, led me to a chair to sit at the back and observe now the inner circle from that position. That, for me, was a very profound moment as I processed that as a very young child, where I could no longer be with my parents, that I had to sit outside and observe that. It's image number one. Image number two, the church was designed in such a way that we would walk down a set of stairs into the Sunday school room after morning worship service. And at the bottom of the stairs, you couldn't avoid a very large image, a very large poster that was on the wall. And I actually believe this poster was quite ubiquitous around, so maybe some of you are familiar with this image. but you couldn't pass it and get into the Sunday school room or the coffee room without engaging this image. And I'm a very visual person. That is my learning style. And so this has been with me ever since. And that poster was a scene of a very large canyon-like crevice that got darker the deeper you got into it. And there were people running towards this crevice and falling off into it, literally by the thousands, it would seem, from the image. And across this crevice was a single white cross to a scene in the back that was obviously light and beauty and those sorts of things. And what always struck me as I came to it was there was only two or three people walking across the cross that was the bridge. And the thousands of people running into the hellfire below it. That image has never left me for my entire life. And I think it's actually very formative in many, many parts of my story. That's my second image. My third image was when I was about 15 years old, which legally made me underage, just for a kind of thought here. When I was able to, because of my profession of faith, and then because of my baptism, I was able to move from that backseat and now sit for the first time in the circle. And on a Sunday morning, be included in that a group that could meet inside that closed circle and participate in communion for the first time. And as the wine came by, it was a shared cup. And as the bread came by, it was actually removing a piece from the loaf. And as I reflected, I can still remember my feelings, which ranged from pride to acceptance to purpose. It was very important to be in that circle, because those who were outside it were in a very different place. And so I was, you know, very pleased to be there. My fourth image. We'll fast forward now to I was 22 years old. And I had met in September of 1993 a beautiful young woman who was not from my tradition. And 5.5 weeks later, I had proposed to her. And thankfully, I'm still married to her 17 years after that. But the speed at which this relationship progressed had caught my church a little off guard, and it was already after my engagement that I was summoned to meet with the elders on a Tuesday evening. Before the Tuesday evening meeting, and there's importance to that, because an event would occur at the Tuesday evening meeting after my meeting with them. I came in, I knew what this was about. And I came in and I sat down, and again, imagine that same upper room kind of setting in a nondescript church building, but the little circle that we were going to meet in, of course, was organized in the backseat area. And I sat down, and they looked at each other, and they said, "Brother Ray," which was the customary greeting in a brethren church, "Brother Ray, we understand that you are engaged." And I said, "Yes, indeed I am. I'm very pleased about that." And they said, and which assembly does your wife," without asking her name, by the way, "worship at?" And I'm a bit of a cheeky fellow, and so I knew what the code word assembly meant, so I responded, "Well, she meets, of course, at the assembly at Aldergrove Baptist Church." And they looked at me after making some knowing glances at one another, and they said, "Brother Ray, we have reason to believe that your marriage and engagement cannot possibly be the will of God." And I looked at them, and I said, "Well, how is that possible?" And they said, "Well, your wife-to-be," again, never asked her name, "she might be of Christ, but she is certainly not in Christ." And I looked at them and I said, "Well, knowing Ginny as I do, I just cannot accept that." And I left, and at that evening meeting that followed, which I was not present at, I was then excommunicated from the church that I had grown up in. Mm-hmm.
That's where I clap.
I appreciate my upbringings in many ways, and other parts of it are that particular moment very tragic, I think. Image 5. In the year 2002, when I just turned 30, we had the birth of our first child. And I left the Brethren Church and followed my wife into a conservative Baptist church where I wrestled with theology for a number of years, mostly to overcome guilt. And at the birth of my child, something very profound happened, which I didn't have language for at the time, because I hadn't met David yet. And he gave me language later for this. And if you'll forgive me for a kind of bluntness in this, I got to hold my baby before my wife did. And that was a watershed moment in my life to this day. There's a story that relates to her birth that's important. But I held her and I looked into the beauty of this perfectly formed child. And all that was running through my head, and forgive me for this, was it's just all bullshit. The whole story of this child is condemned in birth. I couldn't believe it. And didn't have language to work that out, but it was an absolute watershed moment in my life. I couldn't ever return to the theology that I was raised with following that moment. And then, if you'll fast forward a few more years, I've now met David and we've become very good friends, and he was guiding me through a number of conversations, and we were preparing for the passing of my father. And in that particular night, I had escaped the hospital to come to a event called Theology on Tap, which we hold in Vancouver. It's a very civilized event that we hold at a little pub downtown. And we usually have a preeminent speaker like...
Irish pub
downtown. Which, of course, if the elders from the... No, never mind. We often have preeminent speakers like David Goa come speak there. And we were talking about sort of sin and guilt and those sorts of things just afterwards, David and I. And David shared with me that in the Orthodox tradition, they have an expression about to sin boldly and to confess boldly. And of course, this statement made no sense to me at all. And so it really sent me on a kind of journey to discover what exactly the redemptive process actually means. And with those six images, I'd just love to start a conversation about a kind of journey. So, David.
When Ray and I met at the pub, if I recall correctly, that evening I was speaking to the theme that I was speaking to was a body theology, mm-hmm. a scandal to the Puritan and foolishness to the sensualist. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then your father was in this crisis moment in his health, from which he recovered.
Mm-hmm.
Just personally, it's important to note that Ray's father is appears to be at the River Styx today as well. So the context is the question is mm-hmm. is a great question and deeply personal, and mm-hmm. part of what I so appreciated from our conversation a number of years ago, and what flowed from that is that in your relationship with your father, there also has been the ability to have some restoration in that as well.
Yeah.
But to the question.
Yeah. At the point where I came along, I'm very much an afterthought child. So I have three older brothers and siblings that are 13, 15, and 17 years old, older than I am. My parents had to come to grips already with the fact that the church actually could possibly have fallacies within it. And so I think there was a relief on some level that I was going to marry into happiness, as opposed to two of my three siblings, which married in the church and had terrible marriages already. And so for my parents at that point, especially for my mother, she was okay with it. If I'd been one of my siblings at the same age, I would have been probably gone through a period where I would have been ostracized from the family as well. Because that is a part of the mechanism of guilt that works in that community, that you're stepping out of truth, and that's a very difficult thing to process. But by the time I came along, there was a certain acceptance, maybe even a relief about it, to be precise.
How did they respond to the excommunication?
They were more disappointed in the... Their ideal would have been that Ginny would have been received into the church. That would have been their ideal, to be precise. I think they were disappointed in this position that the elders took so quickly to create that line that would have permit her to come. And which I think is quite interesting, too, because it's a church that's supposed to be about spreading the gospel. You think a move to try to include her as opposed to exclude her would have been more appropriate.
But I mean, it's a church that speaks about spreading the gospel.
Right, exactly. And it would also be a church that would believe that anyone outside of their community is operating outside. They had a metaphor from the Hebrew tradition about being in the camp and out of the camp. Kind of an Old Testament image, and they would very much use that metaphor to describe all other Christians. That they're, you know, they would have a faith, but they're not in the camp. And so I found it very ironic that there was no, are you going to bring her here? You know, do you intend to ask for her to be received into the church? None of that. It was just, you've made this mistake, and we're trying to talk you out of it. If you're not going to be talked out of it, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Nobody made the point that in the Old Testament it says you should leave your father and mother and become one.
No, but it's an excellent point. You know, and I don't want to be overly critical, because the formation of my youth was important to my current faith. And I think it gives me a context from which to be, when we get to the broad faith conversation today, it gives me a context from which to be redeemed. And there's a beauty in that for me, that you can't know your current place without knowing where you've come from. And to me, when I'm able to sit with a much broader and inclusive understanding of what the Christian faith means, my upbringing has everything to do with understanding that, and creates a beauty for me in that.
And just a question: were the committee that you met with, were they more angry
elders,
or were they
elders
more hurt?
They were judgmental.
With anger?
But that's interesting. Were they more angry or were they more hurt?
Right,
is the way it's been put.
Certainly, the chairman who did the speaking, who was somebody in terms of the dynamics of this small community of churches that would meet, who knew my grandfather very well, he used both anger and guilt. And at one point he asked me what would my grandfather, who had passed on, would think of this moment. And I just, you know, I didn't have an answer. So he employed
both. You didn't say that now he's in paradise, he would love this moment. You missed that.
I missed that opportunity.
Now that he's in paradise, he really knows what he means.
Yeah.
Love this moment.
Good cheeky mistake.
As I looked around the room, I would have said that there would have been disappointment on the faces of some of the... So I was considered a kind of young up-and-comer in the church. I preached in the church, some of those sorts of things, and so I think there was also a sense of loss as well. But certainly the person who handled the conversation was very judgmental and had tones of both anger and guilt in terms of how he managed the conversation. Yeah.
What was the excommunication?
What was the relationship with his siblings as a result?
At the time, it was mixed. The irony is that none of my family, including my parents, are still members of this church community. So
you say none?
None. Right? They've all now, I like to say I've led them out. I think that would be, overstating the truth. But they've all had to come to wrestle with their own moments of disconnect since. One of the things I wanted to talk about today is overcoming the kinds of control mechanisms that existed in the faith, and how do you process your way past? Like, there are still moments where I will sit in church and question I'll catch myself questioning my own, to use the terms of my upbringing, my own salvation. I'll catch myself doing it and go, what am I thinking? Like, but it's so pervasive to this day. And so I think for my siblings at the time, there was this tension between Ray will be happy, you know, he's met the love of his life, and this is great, but is he stepping away, you know? And even in the logic that we probably know absolutely he's fine, there's still enough of this theological underpinnings that you kind of go, you know, kind of thing.
That, I mean, that could be seen as simply the triumph of individualism in a culture of happiness over a culture of spiritual discipline.
Mm.
So could we spend a few moments, I mean, could I just ask you to think back for a few moments on, I mean, these stories, these images you've given us are such strong images. And so that's an engagement, and you've integrated your past, I think, in a remarkable way, that way that has been fruitful to your understanding of yourself as both a person and also as a Christian. Can you take a step back and reflect a little bit on the kind of tight boundary that community has, the notion of all being brothers,
right,
that community has, the very serious forms of initiation that community has, and is there can you see in that what at some point must have been life-giving forms, even if the way in which they played themselves out in your case, and no doubt in the case of your whole family, something had turned in that. What, when you think back on it, is there, can you see in it what might have at some point been the life-giving part of that? And then can you reflect on what you see, at least in that community, as how the turn occurred and how faith ends up being trumped by fear, a stance of discipline and openness sort of trumped by exclusivism?
Right.
I don't know quite how to ask the question, but you know where...
There's a lot of questions in that question.
There's a little bit.
The churches in question evolved out of the Plymouth Brethren movement, which I'm not a church historian, so if there's one present to help me out, this would be great. But from the Plymouth Brethren movement and then the eventual sort of migration of that movement to North America, they came through the revival period of the 19th century, which was a period of... as it was described, great vibrance coming into the Christian community. It formed itself also as a kind of antithesis to a centralized clergy, and so they set themselves up in a way where each church had local autonomy. There was no pastor or clergy that guided it. It was church services. And I still, to this day, in terms of you talk to me about worship and what worship means to me, there's a certain understanding of that I had in my years in the circle that I've never found elsewhere, and that was this kind of spontaneity in worship. There was no script. There was, in their language, a kind of leading of the Spirit. And I remember themes developing in worship services as people rose to pray or offer a hymn that we should sing at this moment or express a testimony. That
it was jazz. Yeah.
It was jazz, yes, indeed. And there was a certain... when it was authentic, a certain vitality to it that was beautiful. And at the same time, without, I think, a centralized clergy to provide leadership, it became the domain of individuals who could rise in power within the church structure. Within my own family, my grandfather was one of these people, and it turns out that on some level he was also a very evil man and used that position to great abuse in all of the kinds of ways that one can imagine this. And so my grandfather's a very dark figure in our history. And so I think that part of the story is that people were able to come power and leadership in these churches because there was no control beyond the local church to measure the qualifications of those people. And there also, I think, developed, and I think this is also part of the story, there developed kinds of forms that if you could mimic them, you could be very successful. Mm-hmm. And so I said this to you last night. Mm-hmm. I went into voice. There's a whole set of intonations in the way that you would speak and pray. And when you and I were just talking, I put myself back in that place, and I haven't been there for 17 years. But there's a way that you sound. There's a way you speak. And all those things. And if you could do that well, you could be successful.
And you could illustrate just with a footnote about what they said to you about... or when you went back recently and you didn't speak.
I didn't speak, but that
was such a great phrase.
I went to a wedding of a friend of mine recently here in the Prairies, and I agreed reluctantly to attend a Sunday morning service at the church, and sat back, of course.
Out of the circle.
And it was actually in one way really wonderful, and then it took a turn. At the intermission between the morning worship service and the Bible study that follows, one of the relatives of my friend who was there, who knew well enough where I was coming from, he again asked me the kind of question, "Oh, you're from Vancouver, and you're a friend of Stan's. And, you know, which assembly do you worship?" And I again used the same cheeky line I used earlier with the elders. At the assembly that meets at Southridge Baptist Church now. And he nodded his head. And so we came back upstairs, and then they have a Bible study, which, again, it's sort of one person sort of reads a verse or verses, and then they talk about it as people are led. And he was sitting right in front of me, and I remained quiet through the whole time. Although the structure might have allowed me to speak, but not being quite clear, I didn't. And he got up after it was done, and he had his Bible in his hand, folded out like this, and he said, "Isn't it wonderful that we actually read God's Word in the church?" And I was sort of stunned by that.
But then you couldn't speak because...
I wasn't sure whether I could speak because in some of their formations, I was sitting in the seat of the unlearned. So I couldn't speak because that would be their term for it, which David wants to use in his class now. You cannot speak because you are in the seat of the unlearned. In terms of trying to return to your question, yeah. I think there was such a great authenticity to this, the birth of the movement. It was stepping outside of the norms of their day to create something new, something different. It was guided by the revivalist preachers who there's much worth in their contributions to the faith. At the same time, it then became the domain of men, quite frankly, who used the positions that were unchecked for their own self-worth. And I recognize that now, looking back, that those individuals, including my grandfather, derived great power from that, and it was unchecked because of the structure.
These tight circles are religious communities which are structured around these very tight circles, mm-hmm. in the Protestant and evangelical world, often strike me as participating in an impulse that we see in the broader church, the impulse that we see reflected in monasticism, mm-hmm. where people enter into a monastic community for deep need, mm-hmm. deep need. You know, I often say the church is a spiritual hospital and monasteries are the insane asylum of that hospital. The people that have really serious conditions,
yeah.
and enter and need something very, very formed and very, very tight. But the tragedy, and a tragedy that I think you pointed to here, is when that is seen as the church,
mm-hmm.
that is seen as the whole piece of the pie.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the inmates take over.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And try to practice. How do you include those tight circles, mm-hmm. especially in those power imbalances?
Yeah. Well, I think he'll be shocked to meet me in heaven one day. But
it'll be hell for him.
If I can answer that, is two ways. I think there's two type of people who are left in the church, and one of the things that's interesting in my role as a high school teacher, there is a community in my constituency, and so I teach children who come through. There are those for whom the belief is so powerful that everybody outside their community is outside of God's will and purpose for their lives, that they don't know how to have a conversation with you at all that's spiritual. They will be very friendly, but as soon as you turn that conversation to anything, they just have to disengage you because they don't have a context for which to talk to you. And so you just respond in grace. You maintain relationship. You maintain friendships. Because the other group of people that are there, as these churches are dying, to be honest, are a group of people who, on one level or other, are going through a kind of cathartic experience about their faith. And they look, and especially in the multimedia age that we live in, they're looking beyond and they're realizing, you know, it's entirely possible that the baby finger of the body of Christ is actually not the only part that's right. And they will eventually engage you in conversation. And they will ask you, so tell me, you know, how have you dealt with this? How have you dealt with that? And, you know, is it possible? And, you know, the kinds of fascinating conversations that go on. And I think that the stretch becomes how far they can go beyond the articulation. And I think one of the great blessings I had was the meeting with the elders when I was 22, because it released me. And you know, now I would describe myself as a very, very inclusive person for whom I would probably be the other extreme now. That who I would include in the definition of a child of God would be a challenge maybe to some people even in this room, in that sense. So I've come, you know, a really long way. And I really value the benchmarks along the way. Maybe that's not the markers for which they gave me a certain kind of language of understanding where I've come from.
What's your thought about inner group?
I want to press it one more, because mm-hmm. I've come.
They would likely talk to you about that because it's in their world a secular issue.
Okay. So they do compartmentalize.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
This is entirely a compartmentalized faith. They will do business. I mean, they're business people. They're, you know, I have a very good friend for whom one of the head people now in the church, somebody I grew up with, is their accountant. And, you know, I always have this joke, do you talk to Russ about this? Do you tell Russ where you go to church? And I kind of joke with him a little bit. But, yeah, I mean, they compartmentalize the faith completely away into a different space.
And they would never run for mayor.
Oh, absolutely. They won't. You're not allowed. You're advised not to even vote. Because the notion of being in this world but not of this world is a very, very powerful image for them. Yeah.
Rick had a question.
I would say in a very affirmative way. I've come to understand that the kingdom of God is now, not in the terms of how I grew up, where it was something to be striven after into this idea of eternity, and that
which doesn't include
that
eternity, which doesn't include time,
which doesn't include time, and that in the kingdom of God, that how we define the term child of God is not an exclusive term. It's an inclusive term of us in humanity. And so the gospel for me has changed its formation dramatically from my upbringing, which was to go and make converts and stand on street corners and proclaim the idea that if you don't churn, you will burn, right? To a kind of conversation about today, for me, the gospel is inviting people into the redemption that has been already provided. Right? It's already given. You're just not living inside it, potentially. And living inside it means now. And in that sense, my relationship with all of my peers around me is now one that is spiritual, because everything is spiritual. There used to be an old expression in my faith that I grew up in: how is your spiritual life?
Yeah.
It's a stupid question, because everything is spiritual. And in that sense, I can now participate in beauty, for example, in a way I never understood before. Because somebody who might self-proclaim themselves to not be a person of faith can create beauty because the spark of the divine in them brings that beauty out. And so the whole world has opened up to me in a kind of way that it never was before. And I find myself in deeply moving, powerful experiences all the time. You know, and somebody will say, well, give me an example of that. And I went to watch a performance of Wicked with my wife the other night, this famous Broadway play right now that's a recreation of The Wizard of Oz. Well, the irony of the moment, the woman who played the role of Agatha, the Wicked Witch, was a beautiful, beautiful singer. And I realized at some moment during that performance I was worshiping. And
in a Wiccan environment.
And what I mean by that, I was participating in beauty.
Yeah.
And I would never have had that moment previously. So that's what I mean by this kind of movement in my life, to being able to participate in life in a way that is very powerful to me now. And you know, some people say that sounds kind of new agey, and I sort of don't care, because in the sense that it's become very real for me in that sense. And
thank you.
Yeah.
Is that, you want to pick up on that in some way, or push it?
Interesting question. I'm going to have to process that more later.
How compartmentalized are you? have you maintained that compartmentalized thing?
I fight it off. The story of my daughter, holding Maddie, that's her name, was utterly the watershed moment in my life around this, because I had, first of all, a new understanding of who I was. I had a new understanding of beauty, and I certainly had a crisis of faith. And
crisis of theology, of the language of faith.
Yes. And it was a crisis that took 3 or 4 years before I found any sort of language to resolve it with. I really did go through a kind of desert experience where I didn't have any language to describe what I now felt.
Isn't that interesting? Because that was an experience of faith.
Yes.
I mean, from a kind of classical perspective, yeah. It was a stance mm-hmm. of recognition mm-hmm. of what faith is mm-hmm. with your child. And that gives you the crisis of theology.
Yeah, crisis of theology.
That's charming.
And part of the reason why that was such an emotional moment for me was that her birth came on the... followed an exceptional tragedy in my life where somebody very, very close to me was murdered by her brother. And my daughter is actually named after her. And so her birth was a redemptive process in a whole lot of ways anyways. for the parents who are relatives and who we're very close to, and who are her aunt and uncle, that whole moment had all kinds of pieces to it. And so I was dealing with justice in the year before she was born. How do you deal with justice inside a family where a brother murders a sister? I was dealing with the range of emotions from anger to love, and this is still somebody for whom we must deal with. And the notion of punitive justice just didn't have an answer. And then my child was born into the middle of this, and the whole era of life was very, you know, the years between 2001 and 2003 were just an unbelievable set of experiences for me to go through. And so, to answer the second part of your question, the idea that I grew up with about what happened theologically at the cross was a kind of understanding of the gospel that was, we are saved from the judgment that follows this life. There was very little that was understood about the participatory nature of our time in this creation. The entire conversation about what was about what comes after. So redemption as an idea simply boiled down to, you have been condemned already, John, whatever, and now you're being moved positionally into a place where you're not condemned, and the result of that will be one day you get to walk the streets of gold. And that was the limit of the idea of redemption. There was the idea of beauty was not part of the conversation at all. And when I understood an incredible kind of beauty when I held my daughter, it did definitely send me on, I needed to understand this more. Because I now have come to understand that the redemptive process was for all creation. And so that we can participate in it fully and find beauty in all things in a kind of fullness. And that, to me, has been probably the greatest part of my journey, to be honest. You know, I sometimes ask people who don't understand this, I say, when you sit on a beach and you observe a sunset, how do you know it's beautiful? How do you know? It's something speaking from within to you about this. And the limits of my faith earlier was that could not be put into a kind of conversation about God and redemption. Okay, and that's the movement.
Where does the word we use, fundamentalist, mm-hmm. include a whole bunch of things?
Yes.
Whereabouts do you make this break that you feel that you have come
right.
to understand?
As in when I've made it, or in terms of the...
How?
You know what, it's interesting how things happen. You ask questions of the right people, though you don't know you're asking the right people. And I was working through this whole justice part of trying to deal with this, and I was sitting with somebody who we know, David Jennings, and I just asked him sort of what he understood about, you know, evil, and which of course led to a conversation about hell, for which I only had one articulation at that point. And within about a week, I had delivered to my home this stack of books that I had to read, and those were important in the transition and starting to unpack the notion of the various different ideas of what hell can be. You know, both literally, metaphorically, the hells we create for ourselves in this world, and you begin to realize, wow, it's so much of this is my response to things.
And the hell of finding somebody in heaven that yes. should have been in hell, and so it makes this hell
exactly
heaven hell yeah. for you. I understand the problem.
The my last image, which was the one of David saying to me, you know, in the Orthodox tradition we have this expression where you sin, you know, if you sin boldly, sin boldly, confess boldly.
Or bolder still, ask for the grace of God.
And, you know, the idea that again, from a redemption standpoint, that I'm not to go through life with this kind of relationship with the Almighty that is defined by everything I've done wrong. That's not the relationship. And so, moving past that, and I will tell you that you asked me earlier about the kinds of controls and symbolisms and stuff like that comes from my upbringing. It is awfully hard to undo those things. And I still will catch myself from time to time going, actually, some of the things I say to my children from time to time, I go, wow, did I just say that? You know? One of my father's favorite disciplines, for example, was, you know, depending on how bad I'd done, you know, I would get the spankings, of course, but one of his favorite things was to make me memorize scripture as punishment for what I did wrong in life. You know, and so be sure your sin will find you out. It was one of the earliest verses I had to memorize as a result of
and you haven't forgot it.
Haven't forgot, King James Version and all.
Yeah.
So, because there isn't any other version, right? So I don't know if that answers your question. I would say it's a process. I'd say I'm still in it. I will say this, that I am now excited about faith and spirituality and the engagement of our world and understand the kingdom of God in a kind of way that, you know, I think what faith is supposed to do for us, that I get up every morning with a kind of excitement. You know, I'm excited about this conversation today because it's about interactions in the kingdom in that sense, right?
A little just historical note. Most historians, when they're analyzing, looking at the development of fundamentalism in America, because it's an American creation, see its roots in the tradition that Ray comes from, and in the Plymouth Brethren movement coming across the Atlantic, and the way in which that creates a new kind of religious making on the Great Plains. And, of course, the experience of the revival movements and what have you. So there is an intimate connection with what is normally, by historians of religion, referred to as an American Christian fundamentalism.
Do we not all fight that temptation to try to weigh both of them out and pick the best one?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, there's a variety of options for human beings. Mm-hmm. Nick.
Yes, the kind of exclusivism that you vividly describe.
One of the things I have reflected on is that I've never belonged so clearly to something as I did to that community in the short years I was there. And what I mean by that is being absolutely sure of a self-identity. Now, ultimately, it was rejected by me, but in the time that in the now of those moments, of really the formative years of my life, you know, 15 to 22, I belonged, right? And not only did I belong to the truth, which is a very powerful place to be in.
Especially when you're a teenager.
Especially when you're a teenager, yes.
That's interesting that is coterminous for you with your teens.
Yeah.
And what the teenage mind is like.
Isn't that a problem of the broad faith unarticulated, though? Is that feeling?
If I can just, sort of the two questions about fundamentalism, which also comes to yours, I think that sense of belonging is the elusive piece. If the churches go on to survive, it's because people can belong to something. And I think in this particular era, which we live in, which is probably post-modern now, that idea of belonging is very attractive. And I also think I do some work in my consulting side of my world on the generations and how the generations interact with various different communities. And certainly for my generation, I'm solidly in the middle of the Gen X. I'm 39 as of today. Not as of today. And for a Gen Xer, we actually have no belonging at all as a generation, and so the appeal, if the churches survive, the appeal will be that they can offer a kind of belonging that is very, very solidly rooted. And so is it a recipe for extinction? It certainly appears to be at this point. You know,
How do you fit into your present assembly?
Oh, dear. That's a very... yes, I attend a Baptist church today. I probably couldn't sign the statement of faith, which I haven't...
Demanded.
Which, if this is being recorded... that being said, I believe this very passionately because I'm very disturbed by the sort of church moving, church shopping, church whatever that we see today. I belong to a community of people who are on this journey through life together. They are my people, and I won't ever leave my church. In the sense, because I mean, that's a very bold statement, but I really believe that these are my people. That is cultural. It is spiritual. It has nothing to do with dogma on some level. And so, there are times when it is difficult for me. And my pastor knows very well. He's a good friend. It's times that are difficult where I find myself at struggle with the dogma. But at the same time, I can't justify this shifting between places simply on the basis of an idea. These are my people.
It's so interesting to me that the, you know, doctrine, dogma, theology are such wonderful playgrounds of meaning for the human family. And, you know, it's not many people that are... you know, particularly inclined to theology, but there are some that are. We must remember that those are all secondary worlds. They are worlds of description, after all. And the primary world is a world of experience and of relationship. And part of what happens when you say you perhaps couldn't sign the statement of faith, what I read in your comment there is that if the statement of faith is placed there as if that's, if all the experience and all the relationship is reduced to that, you must sign the statement of faith, otherwise you have no relationships. I mean, if that's said as it was said, really, in the closed circle or the meeting with the elders, it strikes me, they were replacing the statement of faith with the relationship. They weren't holding that intention anymore. Or another lovely way of putting it, an old Buddhist, Zen Buddhist comment, you know, don't look at the finger, look at the moon. It's not that the finger isn't important, pointing to the moon, but the finger isn't the moon. And it's this kind of confusion that can occur so easily between the secondary world of description and of playful idea. And again, I take nothing away from that. I love theology and the philosophical world. But these are also secondary worlds. They're not the primary world. And it's how that relationship sits and how vital that relationship can sit.
I have a metaphor for this that I wish I'd have when you asked your question. That when I describe my journey to people, I say, you know, I used to kind of be on a hamster wheel of religion, just sort of running there and pursuing the idea from death to life in a way that actually wasn't a journey at all. Whereas at some point along this journey, I stepped out of the hamster wheel, and now it truly is a kind of journey from death to life, in a bit different meaning for those two terms now. And to me, when you know, what's my gospel now is to really, I think, making disciples, you know, in terms of the great commandment, is to help people off of the hamster wheel of religion, you know.
Or any other hamster wheel.
Or any other hamster wheel there are.
The hamster wheels of ideology.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever it might be.
Sometimes, instead of salvation, it's more a theological term in the sense of sanctification.
You could move by changing, you take a risk.
Huge. I was about to interrupt you when you first said, I would say daily. I would say daily to the doubt conversation. Here's the beauty of that. I learned the difference between knowledge and faith at some point in my life. I had a lot of knowledge. And in many ways, I think I was incubated in a kind of Bible school that was the Bible school of the Jonathan Edwards and Darby's and those worlds. And I could play with the best of them at that point. But it was knowledge. It wasn't faith. And the doubt is necessary for faith.
What do you mean by that?
I don't think we can truly know God unless we can doubt ourselves. And, you know, I think that godliness...
Can you truly know yourself unless without doubting God?
Well, let me just...
Yeah, sure.
I think godliness, defined scripturally, is knowing God, knowing myself, and knowing the difference. And you can't have that without doubt. In my world. And so
you also doubt your knowing.
I doubt my knowing.
The nature of your knowing, yeah. Including the nature of your knowing God.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And to me that was very freeing, but yet I agree with you that it's a less sure place to go through life. Absolutely. You know, I had an exchange with one of the pastors in my church about a book and an author of a book. And he was going to preach against the book. And I sent him a note that I said, you know, before you do that, you know, think about a few things. And he sent me back a very cryptic message where he basically insinuated that won't it be going back to hell? Won't it be interesting when this so-called Christian author wakes up in hell? Discovers he's in hell. And he was being funny more than he was being serious for the moment. And I simply wrote him back and I said, you know what's the difference between you and I, Greg, is that I don't think it's my business at the end of the day. And this is a problem, though, because how we relate to other people, if you talk about my journey, is the world was once really clearly divided into believers and unbelievers for me, and it was easy to tell the difference. I think we're all believers in something. The question is in what? And that is a very different place to operate from as a center. And so, yes, to answer your question, it's a daily exercise for me. And some days it's beautiful, and other days it's a whole set of different questions.
I just had a little footnote to this. I mean, it is instructive that one of the 12 apostles is the patron saint of doubt.
Yes.
And the patron saint of empiricism. And his name is Thomas. And that we have that narrative in the gospel is a revelation. That doubt is a holy matter. And a good. Not the only thing, but it's also a holy matter.
Mm-hmm.
You wanted to...
I was just saying, thank you.
I don't think of myself as a scholar, interestingly. I'm intimidated by this guy over here.
So am I.
We all are.
Are we all? We're all intimidated.
What I wish for my generation is as I walk through life with a lot of 30-somethings and is that this impending sense of purposelessness because they haven't even done what you've done in the sense that filled the doubt with faith. I'm not even sure they know how to do that. And that is a deeply concerning thing to me. And I think, I'm not sure, but I think the fault lies in the fact that we place dogma at this level of faith. And it's entirely likely that the dogma has been defeated. And so what's left? And I think that will be the crisis in the church in the next 30 years, is we have seen these movements to deinstitutionalize the church, to tear down the faith. We call it, you know, emergent or whatever you want to call it. At the end of the day, I don't think it's a movement, but it's a symptom of an entire generation that doesn't believe in the dogma anymore, but has no other language to fill the space with. And that's a crisis.
Or to engage.
Or to engage. And
that's the other problem.
And I know this again. You know, I talk about my church as being my people. Well, the number of people I talk to for which, if you ask them really interesting questions, some of the litmus test questions, like, do you think Gandhi's in hell? They just look at you with this deer in the headlights look because they don't want to answer the question. And it tells me that they actually don't believe the dogma that stands at the identity that they take on. They just actually don't believe it. And nor do they have any language with which to work out from and have a conversation about that. Or you know, so that's what I really worry about, is that, you know, this journey is one without a solid bottom to it, I agree. And I'm also part of a generation that actually doesn't have a solid bottom in a whole lot of other areas as well, at the end of the day.
But what you've pointed to is a commitment to a community of people.
Yeah.
Like a particular community of people. You're going to work it out here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you also have both inherited and continue to cultivate your theological world. That is this secondary world of consideration and thinking around it. Those are pretty huge matters.
Understanding to try to connect.
Exactly. If I can jump in and respond, I think, and actually I'm with you in many ways, the concern I have maybe isn't about the generation and the one that follows mine. It's actually about, at the moment, the response of the establishment, if I can say that way, to the generations. And I fear a kind of political fundamentalism evolving. And again, I'm not a I need you to do this for us, Nicholas. You know, as I understand the Reformation, there was this kind of leaping forward that was responded to by the establishment of the day in a very violent way. And I'm not so sure I don't see some of the same thing going on, as there's a kind of emerging of a set of ideas that are maybe more diverse, and then you have the fundamentalist response to it, which is, you know, and I will only point to the fact that when Rob Bell released the book Love Wins, it was the second highest thing that was trending on Twitter. And a very leading theologian actually tweeted, "Farewell, Rob Bell." And all, you know, my look at that, I don't care if you think Rob Bell's right or wrong, he's injecting a set of questions into the conversation. If you simply respond with, "Farewell, Rob Bell," you immediately isolate those who might read that book and go, "Oh, this," you know. And so my concern is more that there isn't the space with which, as freely as you gave it to your children, I don't know if the space is there for these questions.
So your question is more about the church.
My question is more about the church, yes.
And what the church's capacity is for,
to deal with this.
For this matter.
Well,
do we need to close?
Well, we need to formally bring it to an end. Thanks so much, Ray.
Can I say just something?
Please.
In closing?
Yeah.
Because your image reminded me of something that ties back to the comment about truth. One of the unpacking of scripture that occurred during my journey was a rearticulation of the prodigal son story that asked a really interesting question partway through. And the person who was giving this talk said, you know, the prodigal son story has been in the center of the gospel for so long, but where is Jesus? And I went, wow, that's actually a really fantastic question. You know, we focus on the son, we focus on the image of God. And what he said to me that was really powerful in this idea of truth, he said, you know, Jesus is in the far off land, pointing the prodigal back to the Father. He's not written in on purpose. And there's an incredible beauty in that, that this is so about pointing in a direction as opposed to telling us that we're right in a place. And I've always appreciated that. And so my search so much now is about, where are you pointing? Where's God? Where's the Father? You know, in that sense. Yeah. If that even helps a little bit in terms of what you asked about. Yeah.
So thank you so much, Ray. Mm-hmm.